Good morning, everyone. I'm Graham Rutherford. I'm an alcoholic. And welcome to the Simple Actions mini conference. Okay. For those that would care to join me, let's open with the Serenity Prayer. God, grant me the serenity to accept the things I cannot change, courage to change the things I can, and the wisdom to know the difference. Amen. I'll read the preamble to Alcoholics Anonymous. Alcoholics Anonymous is a fellowship of men and women who share their experience, strength, and hope with each other that they may solve their common problem and help others to recover from alcoholism. The only requirement for membership is a desire to stop drinking. There are no dues or fees for AA membership. We are self-supporting through our own contributions. AA is not allied with any sect, denomination, politics, organization, or institution. Does not wish to engage in any controversy. Neither endorses nor opposes any causes. Our primary purpose is to stay sober and help other alcoholics to achieve sobriety. So just some housekeeping. Please turn off your cell phone. Thank you. The coffee will be cut off by Judy in 30 seconds, so those people better hurry up. And there will be more coffee served at the break. If you need to use the restroom during the meeting, please do not go through that door there. Please go up and walk down through the room to access the restrooms and come back that way. Thank you. And we respectfully ask that once the meeting's underway, wherever possible, people refrain from getting up and moving around the room so that everyone can listen uninterrupted and free of distractions. Thank you. There's a free recording available of last night's meeting and all the workshops that are going to take place today. You can find it on our website, which is simpleactions.net. Our home group meets on Monday nights at 7 o'clock at First Presbyterian Church off Colonial. Everybody's welcome. It's an open step study meeting. And so today's schedule, this meeting, the topic was alcoholism, what's the problem? And Bob's kindly agreed to come up and talk with us about that. So without further ado, it's Bob D from Las Vegas. Thank you.
Thanks, Tom. Did you actually use the laddies' room yesterday? Morning, my name is Bob and I'm an alcoholic. Hey, Bob. Only through the grace of a God that I was afraid to believe in that I've accessed and maintained in my life through a process outlined in a book called Alcoholics Anonymous, the ability to remain sponsorable and a persistent effort in our primary purpose. I haven't had a drink or any medications or mind-altering substance since October 31st, 1978. I'm a member in good standing of a group in Las Vegas called the Connect the Dots group. And I am proud to be a member of that group. The people, we have some amazing examples of AA there. Activists, sober, we have four activists in our group, over 50 years sober, that go to meetings and do 12-step work and have commitments. They're over 50 years sober, and they're good examples of Alcoholics Anonymous. And a plethora of people in 40-plus years and 30-plus years. I'm kind of, in some groups in AA, at 35 years, I'd be an old-timer. In my home group, I'm kind of a middle-of-the-road guy. And I like that. I don't want to be the old-timer. I want to be a middle-of-the-road guy. And that's good for me, to be around the new people and the whole deal. In about 1971, I had my first exposure to Alcoholics Anonymous, and I was in an institution. It was not my first institution, but it was the first one that made me go to an AA meeting. And I wasn't old enough to take a legal drink. I was a kid, and I was in this institution not for alcohol. I was in there because I had a drug problem. Now, if you would have asked me, and they never did, but if they would have asked me, have you ever had an alcohol problem, I would have said, well, I did, I mean, I got sent away for the first time when I was 15 years old as a result of alcohol. I used to have an alcohol problem, but I discovered that if you did enough drugs, you could kind of get over it for a while. And so I'm not an alcoholic, because alcohol at that time was not my drug of choice. I was a wannabe rock star, you know, and all that, you know, sex, drugs, rock and roll, that kind of thing. And I can't be an alcoholic. I ran away from home and went to Woodstock. I'm not an alcoholic. I mean, but I was. And I was sent to an AA meeting against my will by a counselor who worked there, who lived in the community I lived in, and he had seen me at a party when I started to drink, and there was nothing else around, and what happened to me. When I started, I couldn't stop. And he saw the allergic reaction to alcohol that only occurs in people with a disease of alcoholism. Now, you could have put me on a lie detector and said, Bob, is there any way in the world you're alcoholic? I would have said no, and it would have said I was telling the truth. But I had alcoholism, and I didn't know it. Alcoholism hides from us. When it says in the beginning of chapter 3, most of us have been unwilling to admit we were real alcoholics, that is such a universal thing. People like me go to such amazing lengths not to be alcoholic, even though we are. And I did that, and I didn't want to be an alcoholic. And I was that little side story. I am everything there is to be an alcoholic. I take a drink of alcohol and something overcomes me. I can't stop. But at that period of time when heroin was on the radar, I got out of that treatment center and I'm never going to do heroin again. And I was a young guy and I hadn't been laid in a while. So I knew this girl who hung out down at the Regency Hotel bar. And I was pretty sure, I'd dated her a couple times in the past, and I was pretty sure if I went down, talked to her for a while, she'd probably going to invite me up to her apartment. And so I'm going down there with this hope. And there I walk in, and there she is sitting in there, and I sit down next to her, start talking to her, and she says, can I buy you a drink? Well, back in those days, we puffed ourselves up in a state of superiority by telling ourselves we were heads, we're not juicers. We looked down on the juicers, right? You know, like, which is a bizarre deal to do. But we did that, and this girl says, can I buy you a drink? I said, I'm not really a drinker. She says, can I get you something? She said, no, I just got out of treatment. I'm not doing anything. She says, do you have a problem with alcohol? No, I don't have a problem with alcohol. Can I buy you a drink? We're going to be here for a while. I relented. I said, okay, yeah, give me a rum and coke. They bring me a rum and coke. Well, I drink quickly. I don't know what that's about. Isn't that weird? You know? And I drank that, killed that rum and coke. She's still sipping on the one. And she says, let me buy you another one. I said, you know, I'm not, I went back into my spiel with not as much angst. I'm not really a drinker, you know, I'm a head, but I got out of treatment, I'm not doing anything. And she said, well, let me buy you a drink. I relented a little less adamantly. Yeah, okay. And they got me another rum and coke, and I killed that. Now she's finishing the one she has, and she says the words to me that I came in there hoping to hear. She says, why don't we go up to my apartment? And the second rum and coke had hit me. And I said to her, hold that thought. And I ran across town and banged on a guy's door because of an allergic reaction to alcohol. That it just that at that moment, it showed up in a craving for, Silkworth says it doesn't matter. Years later, it always showed up as a craving for more alcohol. But at that time, because I just came down from a physical addiction to heroin, it showed up like that. And we see that in members of Alcoholics Anonymous all the time. Guys who never even did drugs. And all of a sudden, they'll get back problems or something. They'll get on pain pills. And they can't get off. And then they go to a detox and they get off and they have a drink and then they go chase pain pills. What was that about? I thought they were alcoholic. It just makes a little shift. But the thing that's universal in those of us that have this fatal spiritual malady is that I always will have an allergic reaction to alcohol, regardless of whatever else I get into. Is that it always sets that thing off in me. As the effect of the alcohol hits me, I break out in an irresistible yearning for more. More of what? What do you got? It creates a craving inside of me. And I've always had that. I've never not had that. I've never once in all those years sat in a bar doing shots and beers, shooting pool with my buddies for about an hour and had the bartender say, "Hey, Bob, would you like another one?" I have never had the experience of sitting there and thinking to myself, "No, I'm good, thanks. This is good." I've never had that. It's, "Oh, yeah, one more." Matter of fact, I'm the guy, if I'm still conscious, I ain't done partying. You know what I mean? I went up to Boston one time on spring break, me and a couple guys, to this party we'd heard about that was at the university up there. It was supposed to be amazing. And it was. It was an amazing party. They had kegs of beer and bottles of wine and shots of tequila. And it was an amazing party. Reefer, it was great. And a guy come, I've been drinking there for about an hour or so. And I'm just getting rolling. Because when I was young like that, it seemed like I could drink forever. And I was rolling. And a guy comes through there with a bunch of capsules. And this was back in the, this was before the just say no days. This was the just say thank you days. And I took a couple of them. And I didn't even ask him what they were. It was just like, who cares? This is a party, you know? Yeah. And I took a bunch of, well, it turned out to be animal tranquilizer. Well, that's not good. So in about an hour, I'm laying on the floor and I can't get up. But I'm still conscious, so I'm laying there trying to talk people into bringing me drinks, right? Because of an allergic reaction, because if I'm awake, I ain't done drinking. You know what I'm saying? It's just more and more. And I've always had that. And that is what Silkworth, who was such a brilliant psychiatrist, I don't think we'd be here without him. Silkworth says that this allergic reaction to alcohol that manifests itself in a phenomenon of craving is what differentiates us and sets us apart as a distinct entity. And I'm supposed to talk later today on singleness of purpose, and I'll get into the reason that our survival depends upon this commonality. You can have a lot of other problems here, but you got to have that, because if you don't, we could end up with a fellowship where half the people here could drink successfully and maybe would intermittently and not admit it because they don't want to ruffle the feathers of those AA fanatics. This would become a very unsafe place for us, right? So you can have a lot of other problems, but you got to have alcoholism, or this AA becomes an unsafe place for the alcoholic. And I have alcoholism. I have that phenomenon of craving. I've never not had it. I don't want to admit to myself that I have it. Silkworth talks about this phenomenon of craving. And I remember sitting in my early exposure to AA, it was 19, 20, 21 years old probably, listening to people in AA talk about this allergy to alcohol. I don't have an allergy to alcohol. It's funny how alcoholism uses your own mind against you to hide from you. I don't have an allergy to alcohol. I know about allergies. I got a mild allergy to cats. I get around cats. After about an hour, my eyes start to water and itch. And yeah, but I don't do that with alcohol. And they say, well, it's different. It's not your eyes itch. It's you break out in a phenomenon of craving. No, I don't. I mean, I drink and get drunk, but so do everybody I drink with. Like, we're partiers. It's not a craving. I'm not driven by it. I'll claw the walls for a drink. And the odd thing about a craving is you don't realize you have it until you can't satisfy it. Everyone in this room at this moment is in the grip of a craving you're not aware of, as I am. And that's the craving to breathe air. But if someone were to sneak up behind me and put a plastic bag over my head, I would instantly realize I have a craving to breathe air because I can't satisfy it. And so it's very hard for the alcoholic, the chronic alcoholic, to identify the phenomenon of craving, because we intuitively, and it's not a conscious thing, we don't do it because we think we're alcoholic, but we will intuitively evade situations where you can only get one or two and can't get any more. I remember in junior high school, a guy, his parents were out of town, and it was a Sunday afternoon. Pennsylvania, you can't buy nothing on a Sunday. And he invited me and another guy over. There's three of us, and he has 1 6-pack of beer for three of us to watch some things on TV that day. Three, 6-pack, three guys. I did the math. I said, no, that's all right, thanks. No, I don't say that because I'm an alcoholic. If he'd have had three cases of beer, I'm in, man. I'm in. But it was just like, it seemed like, what's the point? Right? And I don't do that because I think I'm alcoholic. And so it was very, when you tell me about this allergic reaction to alcohol, this phenomenon of craving, I don't have a phenomenon of craving. And then I was sitting in a meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous, and the thing happened to me that only happens here. I listened to someone else talk about them, and I found a little piece of me. Isn't it odd? I have learned more about me listening to you talk about you than I ever could learn about me through intensive self-examination, because I'm so defended. I can't see it. But I'm sitting there, and a woman is talking about her experience at a dinner party, and oh my God, the light went on. I remembered this one incident, and there wasn't many. And this one incident, I was about 18 years old, and I was dating a girl. And she invited me to come to her parents' house that evening for dinner, and I was supposed to spend the whole evening meeting her family. And I don't like things like that. I'm a little self-conscious, and I didn't want them. I know they're going to be looking at me and have me under the microscope, but I'm trying to be a good guy. Okay. I went. I was sober. And they get to the dinner table, and they bring out a bottle of wine. Now, this is not the kind of bottle of wine I would have bought. This is a little wimpy Al-Anon kind of bottle of wine. You know what I mean? This is a little nothing bottle of wine. Low, like 11% alcohol. That's not even enough to do nothing. You know, I like the 20%, it's never seen a grape kind of wine. You know, I like, you know what I mean? That's the kind of wine, that's the kind of wine to take you home. This is like, but, so I'm sitting, now I'm not an alcoholic. At this point in my life, I could admit to having a drug problem of sorts, I guess, but I'm not an alcoholic. We sat down at the dinner table, and alcoholism doesn't care what you think. Alcoholism kills people that don't believe they have it. It doesn't care what you think. Matter of fact, it'll hide itself from you as long as it possibly can. And I don't think I'm an alcoholic. And we sit at the dinner table, and they pour us all a glass of wine, and I drink quick. I think evaporation is some childhood issue with me. I don't like to let a drink sit very long. Even to this day, I'll go out with my daughter or my sister sometimes to dinner, and normal drinkers are bizarre. They'll order a drink and kind of forget it's there. You know what I mean? Talk for a half hour. Like, I just want to go, just drink that, would you? If I don't say nothing, because I don't want to look like a crazy person. I don't say nothing, but it bothers me that they just let it sit there like that. Anyway, because I drink quick, I killed two glasses out of that bottle of wine. That bottle of wine's dead, and they're sipping on their first glass. And I'm sitting there, and I don't know nothing about alcoholism, but I got two glasses of wine in me. And I'm getting a little squirmy. Now, the conversation at the dinner table that a few minutes before had been okay, kind of nice, now it's starting to become irritating and stupid. Do you know what I mean? Just, it's mundane, it's tedious. And I finally blurted out, I said, God, that was good wine. Do you have any more? And they said no, and they went back to talking about sports and movies and news and... I'm sitting there, and I'm just, you know how you talk to yourself in your head? It's getting a little panicky in here. And I finally blurted out, you know, I said, you know, I sure like beer. And they said, well, we don't have any beer, Bob. Next time you come over, we'll get you a six-pack of beer. And then went back to talking. And I'm sitting there, and I feel like I'm losing my mind. And I don't know what's wrong. I'm so antsy and irritable. And I finally excused myself. I went to their bathroom, locked the door. Like a crazy person, I went through their cabinets. I found a bottle, unopened bottle of cough medicine that was 35% alcohol with codeine and turpinhydrate, which is a plus. And sat on the edge of that bathtub and chugged that bottle of cough medicine, and all that irritable spinning in my head just went, ah. And I could think straight, and I came up with a story. I went back out to the dinner table. I explained to them that there was something I forgot about, that I had to take care of, and I was so sorry to leave. And I went out. They were sorry. I said, well, do this again. I went out and I got in my car and I drove down their street like you're supposed to, 20, 25 miles an hour. And I turned the corner and I drove like an insane person, probably 70, 80 miles an hour to my friend Brett's house, because Brett had some Thai stick in a bar in his basement. And I did that because those two glasses of wine lit something in me that could not be ignored. Now, I was the only alcoholic at that dinner table. If those people had been alcoholics, we'd all been in that bathroom going through those cabinets. But something happens to me that doesn't happen to the non-alcoholics. And it's always been that way for me. I've always had that reaction to alcohol. Well, I'm in and out of treatment for several years, and I don't want to be an alcoholic, as we all don't resist this thing. And I finally get intellectually bludgeoned into an acceptance of, you know, you drink and fail and drink, and you try, you tell yourself time and again, I'm not going to go too far, and you do, because alcoholism uses your own mind against you. You don't see the phenomenon of craving. I'm going to go in here, I'm just going to have two. And then in the middle of the second drink, it's like you change your mind. You realize it wasn't two, silly, three. And in the middle of the third drink, three is silly, five. And it's always, because every drink of alcohol I've ever taken in my life makes me feel like I'd like to have another drink of alcohol. And I finally saw that. I got that. I'm that guy. All right, I'm that guy. And I thought, erroneously, and so many of us do this, I thought that knowledge, now that I've accepted that I have that thing, I can't take the first drink no matter what. I thought that, coupled with a sincere, convicted, enthusiastic determination not to ever drink again, I was convinced I'm out of the woods. See, my ego thinks that knowledge is power. It thinks if you know, you can do. What I had no idea is how powerless I was. See, at this point, I think my powerlessness extends to what happens to me once I drink. I had no idea that it goes much further than that. If my alcoholism only extended to what happens to me, my powerlessness was only about what happened to me once I drank, then alcoholism, in effect, would be an acute rather than a chronic condition. That the answer would be abstinence, if that was the case. As all, if you want to know, in our book it talks about the difference between the real alcoholic and what you could consider an acute alcoholic, a problem hard drinker. And the difference is that the hard drinker has within them the ability to carry out a commitment to never drink again, and they're okay with that. I grew up with people like that. I remember I had a buddy that I used to party with, and if you were to watch him party and you watch me party, you might come to the conclusion he was worse than I was. And yet he got married to a girl he was absolutely in love with. She gave him an ultimatum, we can't do this anymore, and he didn't, and he didn't get weird when he got sober. He didn't start to realize what a bitch she was, you know. You know, he didn't do any of that, right? It just, it, it was like he was just good. He was just, he wasn't restless, irritable, discontent. He wasn't prone to depression. He didn't just all of a sudden painfully notice what was wrong with everybody. He just quit drinking. His acute alcoholism ended where the bottle ended. The physical stabilization of his condition was the end of the problem. Just like pneumonia. Pneumonia is an acute illness. Pneumonia is a serious illness. Pneumonia can kill you. But if you have pneumonia, they'll put you in a hospital, they'll load you up with the right antibiotics, they'll knock that pneumonia out once and for all, and you're good to go. You don't need to go to meetings or have a sponsor, nothing. But if you've got a chronic illness, such as diabetes, certain types of heart disease, or chronic alcoholism, the physical stabilization of the condition is but a beginning. It is not the end. It is the beginning of a lifetime of treating, because that's the nature of chronic, is that I will always have to be in some sort of recovery deal in my life, or I get sicker. I'm almost a fanatic scuba diver, and I'm there's about 30 of us all in AA, and we call ourselves the low bottom divers, and we take a couple trips every year. We go to exotic places and scuba dive, and I've been doing this for a long time, and those of us that dive and dove for a long time, we become very fascinated and interested in marine biology. And you know, there's types of sharks that God has created them in such a manner that they never ever stay still. They can't lay on the bottom as a lot of fish do and sleep. When they sleep, they go out into the deep blue abyss, and they sleep, but they have involuntary tail motion. They have to keep going forward because their gills are devised in such a way that water has to flow over them, or they cannot get oxygenated, and if they don't continue to move forward, they actually smother and suffocate. So they never stop. And I am like that. If you're chronic, you're like that. Stop doing AA for a while. Stop praying and helping others and doing personal inventory a while. And watch what happens to your spirit as it fills up with you. Watch what happens to your emotional, spiritual condition. And the deviousness of the alcoholic mind is that when I start to get sick, I don't think I'm getting sick. It looks like you are. It looks like all of a sudden there's a lot of selfish, self-centered, unreasonable idiots in my life. And God has given me this awareness so I could be on the mission of straightening them out. So I am a chronic alcoholic. And, in our book, many, many places, it talks about this. It refers to alcoholism as a spiritual illness, a spiritual malady. They didn't want to use the word disease because they didn't want a contention with the medical profession. And yet, it has all the characteristics of a disease. But the book refers to it as an illness. And what I remember the first time I ever heard someone refer to this thing I have as a spiritual illness, it offended me intellectually. I'd worked as a therapist for a while. I had a big therapy background. It was intellectually offensive. I thought, that's not it. It's all cause and effect in your psyche. It really ties back into your childhood. I had all that crazy stuff in my head. But what the book says, and we agnostics, it says, do not let these terms deter you from honestly asking yourself, in your own experience, what do they mean to you? Not what you think they mean, not the church stuff, not the prejudice. And there was something that was undeniably true in my life and real, is that every time I quit drinking, my spirit my being, my chi, my whatever you want to call it. It's not a religious term. You know, it's that thing that's more of you than you are. That thing starts to withdraw from life and become depressed. It starts to fill up with angst and conflict. It starts to get sick. And in the early days of drinking, when alcohol worked, 4 shots of tequila would vitalize and repair my, it would heal my spirit, and it would set me free. So the thing that I drink to really change is the thing that I have to apply Alcoholics Anonymous to. Right? The book says, is there a substitute? Yes, and it is vastly more than that. And it really is. This is, my friend Scott used to say, this is the only terminal illness that he knows of where people are excited about the treatment. We're going to an AA convention. You know, you won't go to a cancer ward and go, oh, I'm going to have some chemo. It's not like that. This is the only place where the recovery from a terminal illness makes you better and more joyous and happier than you were before you even caught the disease, before you even found out you had it. And that's an amazing thing. And I have this chronic spiritual malady, and I don't, and it's progressive in nature. And we all know that that I get spiritually sicker as time goes on. And what that means is that every time I get sober again, I'm a little worse. I feel a little worse about myself. I have a little more shame, a little more depression. Abstinence feels a little more icky to me. I have a harder time staying sober. My very sense of myself is eroding as if it's being eaten away. And as it deteriorates, rising up in its shadow is this huge ego. As my spirit gets sicker and diminished and my sense of myself gets worse, I grow this big ego as if it's the ultimate compensator. And that's why you'll hear people refer to alcoholism is that we are egomaniacs with inferiority complexes. And that's really true. I'm the guy who can lay in the gutter and realize what's wrong with everybody. Right? I remember I was homeless. I was on the streets in Pittsburgh, and I was horrible. I shook, and every day I just try to get enough of that cheap wine in me just to stop the madness. I was horrible. I had sores that didn't heal because I don't eat right. Sometimes I don't eat at all for days because I don't. And I'm not against eating. I just not eating up my drinking money. I only could hustle so much every day, and you give me a choice. Richard's Wild Irish Rose or McDonald's. McDonald's is going to lose. And so I go for long periods of time. I need the medicine more than I need the food. And you do that for a while, you get real sick physically. And I was real sick physically. And I came to one time, and I put together enough money for a bottle of wine. I'm sitting in the park on the north side of Pittsburgh and trying to get the shakes to stop. And I started thinking about the last conversation that I had with my mother. And my parents wouldn't talk to me anymore. And one of the last, maybe, I don't know if it was the last one, but one of the last ones, maybe 2 years before or so, my mom had to tell me about the people I went to school with and how wonderful they're doing. And how the one guy's a doctor, and the other guy just is building his own house, and he's got his second kid coming, and how the one guy has an insurance agency, and these guys are, and she said something that I already knew. She said, and you were smarter than all of them. And I was. But I was dying of alcoholism. And she's rubbing my face and how great they're doing, you know, and what wonderful lives they are. And here I am living on the streets like an animal. And here's what my ego said to me. It said, yeah, they got all that. They probably couldn't take it living like you live, though. They just kind of puffed up with a little sense of superiority, you know what I mean? Just laying in the gutter looking down on everybody else, you know? What? I hate myself. I just feel like a piece of whale crap. I am a very special piece of whale crap. So when I come to Alcoholics Anonymous and you guys tell me things like the problem is you're self-centered. No, I'm not. You don't understand. I feel very badly about myself. I'm not that guy. I'm not vain. I'm not that guy. I hate myself. And I didn't understand what you were talking about. I did hate myself. I thought about myself continually. And I didn't know that that's what it was to be self-centered and selfish in the business of worrying about, concerned with, obsessed with, worried about me. Sometimes I worry about you if you have something to do with me or something you could give me or something you might take away from me. Then you become on me, you get on my radar. But it's really all about me. And I don't even know him that way. So Silkworth talks about this horrible thing that happens to us. He says that we get physically sober, we become restless, irritable, discontent. And it wears on us. And it's not big. It would be different if it was big restless, big irritable, big discontent. But often it's not. Often it's just a subtle gnawing of discontent. A subtle gnawing of irritability. This life is just just a subtle restlessness, an inability to really get a sense of being settled and peaceful and comfortable anywhere. And it just gnaws away at me. And I was probably a year or two sober, and I saw a movie on TV. It had nothing to do with alcoholism. It was a movie about spies during the Cold War. And it was a very interesting movie. There was this scene where the communists had captured this American CIA agent who was a spy. And he evidently had these secrets about some new weaponry that was in some aircraft or something. And the communists are hell-bent to torture these secrets out of this guy. Well, this is a James Bondish kind of guy who's been trained by the CIA. He's torture-resistant. He's a tough, macho guy. And they got this guy strapped to a chair, and they're beating him. They cut off one of his fingers. They even brought in a generator with these electrodes. And they put him on his private parts, and he'd just wither in pain and they did that to him for days, and he didn't give nothing up. He's a tough guy. I'm the guy you just show the wires to, you know what I'm saying? Whoa, what do you want? I'll tell you anything you want. I'll clean your house, anything. I mean, just show me those wires, man. I'm telling you. Woo. And he's a tough guy, man. He ain't giving nothing up. They've tortured this guy for a week or two. And he's hanging in there. And then finally this little Chinese doctor comes in. And he bows and he says, "My name's Dr. Chang. You will tell me everything." And this macho spy laughs in his face and says, "Doc, I ain't telling you nothing. What are you going to do to me? You've already done it all. I ain't telling you nothing." He says, "I give you Chinese water torture." He says, "Water torture? You hit me with a fire hose the other day. I ain't telling you nothing." He says, "No fire hose. One drop." "Doc, one drop of water? You think I'm going to break for one drop? Hit me with a bucket of water." "No bucket. One drop." And they bring this apparatus over where he's strapped in the chair, and they put it above his head, and it just starts. "Ha ha, I ain't telling you nothing. Hey, do it again." And they leave him alone in the room with... And after 3 days, he's begging them to let him tell them everything he knows, if they'll just make it stop. And he can't understand. He could handle a lot of pain, but he couldn't handle that. And that's what alcoholism does to guys like me. It's just day in and day out, the restless, the mild irritability, the discontent, the loneliness, the low-level depression. It's just day in and day out, week in and week out. And it just erodes away my resolve gradually until all of a sudden I can't think of anything or see anything or remember anything. All I can see is this desperate yearning to get free. That's all. And the only way I've ever known to get free just like that was about 4 shots of tequila or a half a bottle of wine or a hit off of something. And the obsession to drink returns, but it's not really an obsession to drink. The obsession isn't with Budweiser. The obsession is with an effect. It's with the medicine. And I yearn for the medicine because my spirit is sick. And I never understood that. I never saw it. I don't know why. That's when it refers to us as a baffled lot. And it is. It's alcoholism's baffling. You know, I could suffer a lot of stuff. It's not that I didn't have willpower. I just didn't have willpower in this arena. I had some willpower. I remember, man, I needed this job badly. And I would go to work and I'd be sick and hungover and I couldn't drink there. And I'd just muscle my way through that misery every day. And I'd get off work and I'd go get that bottle and get that relief and I'd drink. And sometimes I'd drink till 4 or 5 in the morning and I had to be at work at 7. And I'd make myself sick in that terrible twilight where you're not drunk and you're not sober, you're half sick and half rummied up, you know. And I'd make myself go in there miserable and work. That throwing up can become a way of life. Some of us can walk down the street, throw up, don't even hit our shoes. Just keep going. It's not that I don't have willpower. I have a lot of willpower. Go to a PTA meeting. See how many people you can get to sign up for a life like that. They wouldn't put up with it for one day of making themselves that sick. And we did. We lived with it. We lived with it. It's a way of life. I just don't have any power to resist the internal clamoring for the relief. I have nothing. And one of the things about alcoholism that's so baffling, it's all because of the nature of the powerlessness and how, if you have the mind of a chronic alcoholic, how this sickness uses your own mind against you. The more you fight the bottle, the stronger it gets. How many people in this room, besides including myself, have gotten to points where you had made a sincere, you knew, man, and you made up your mind, I'm never touching that stuff again, and then went back to it. Anybody? Right. I was new in AA in 1978, and I heard this speaker say something, and I almost fell off my chair. It was so brilliant, and it was so right. You know, we all have, I think there's a collective unconscious here. Carl Jung talked about it. And when you hear, we all have that experience where you'll hear something you've never, ever heard before. And you hear it, and it's like you never heard it, but yet like you always somewhere inside yourself knew it. It resonates in this, I think it's like the collective conscious that Jung talks about. And I sat in this meeting, and this guy said something and it just knocked me off my chair. It was unbelievable. He said, man, he said, I swore off drinking seriously over 50 times. I quit. I quit seriously 50 times. I meant it. He said, every time I quit drinking, I got drunker than ever. And he said, you know, that quitting drinking was killing me. I thought, oh my God, that's right. And I stand here next week, 35 years. I've not quit drinking. I don't fight the bottle. When I was fighting the bottle, I always lost. I always lost. You guys told me that I was fighting in the wrong arena. And you pulled me out of the arena of fighting the bag and the bottle, and you put me in the right arena, arena where I got a shot, arena where I could access power to fight the real problem. Not the alcohol, but the alcoholism, the spiritual malady, the obsession with self, the conflict, the separation, what was really wrong. And I've been fighting in that arena for all these years. And it doesn't feel like a fight most days, but sometimes there are times in sobriety where you get those desolate stuff happens, you know. Bill used a term in the 12x12. He said that pain is the touchstone of all spiritual growth. I thought that he meant that it was a catalyst. No, it's the test. The touchstone is to measure whether something's made right. They used to use touchstones in medieval times when a guy who's made swords would, after he made the sword, if it was forged right, he could slam it on this touchstone and it would ring. It would make like music, ring, ring. If it wasn't, it would crack and shatter. And they also used touchstones to tell. They had this mythical touchstone that would tell the difference between gold and other metals, right? And a touchstone is the measure. In other words, if you're going through pain and you drink again, AA didn't fail. You missed something. You haven't, as Bill says, you haven't perfected and enlarged your spiritual life. And Bill promises that. He says, and if the alcoholic fails to perfect and enlarge his spiritual life, and it's through two things that you would not think would be the two things involved in perfecting and enlarging your spiritual life. He says, it's not through prayer and meditation. I would have thought that. He says, it's through self-sacrifice and constant work with others. That is how I will perfect and enlarge my spiritual life. Which is not good news to selfish people. You know, all that altruism's nice, but I've got to take care of me. You know, what about me? You know, if I ever get my life exactly the way I want it, I'll go help someone. I don't want to inconvenience me. We don't want to do it. And yet, our lives depend upon it. And over the years, what happens to guys like me who are, I'm recovery resistant. I remember coming to AA and I had some problems with alcoholics. And well, for one, AA was full of people. Oh, man. Sober, I need alcohol to merge with people. You know what I mean? I don't know how to get along with people sober. I got a head that is people resistant. I remember we'd be in this halfway house and they'd put us in the loser van, you know, and they'd bring us to AA meetings, you know, and we'd walk in the back of the room and I swear it felt like everybody's looking at us, you know. So I'm standing back there. Everybody else kind of sits down. I'm standing there. Where am I going to sit? I'll sit. Yeah, I'll go sit with those people. No, then they're going to think you like them or something. I don't want to sit. Oh, now they saw you look at the chair. Or I'll go sit with those people. Now that guy's going to think something. Well, if I sit there, then what are they going to think? And they don't look like they really want me to sit there now that I look at them. And I'd end up standing in the back of the room for the whole meeting. Right? Because I got a head that's just, it's just nuts. And you guys talk about God. Oh, that is not good. I love that line in the book where he says, it's a thing that the guy thinks he's evaded the issue of God. You can't evade it. There is a power in this universe. And it's our only hope. And you know why you know that? Because you've tried everything you can try. Well, in the ABCs, it's the second B says that probably no human power could have relieved our alcoholism. It could have taken away the madness and the sickness that is pushing you to relapse yourself to death. No human power. And you know how you know that? Because we try. We try everything. I mean, who do you think buys the self-help books? I mean, we do. I mean, you want to find an untreated alcoholic? Go to a bookstore. Go to the recovery section. You'll see guys just looking around like, who goes to the seminars? It's funny. There was a thing in Vegas called a few years ago. It was started by some therapist. They were trying to capitalize on. They wanted to become an Anthony Robbins person. They created this thing called Vision, and it was they took elements from Est and Psy and different things and put them together and made this thing that was very marketable. And it had a lot of fluff and a lot of panache to it, and it was very cool. And a friend of mine, a guy that I sponsored, went and checked it out. And I said, are you going back? He said, no. He said, I don't like this. He said, it was shallow. I didn't really care for it. I said, what was it like? He said, well, he said, there was about 20 people I've seen in AA meetings that don't want to work the steps. With a bunch of other people that are probably family members of alcoholics. We resist this thing. Alcoholism, this will sound crazy, but this is just my observation of my own experience and the experience of many, many, many guys I've worked with over the years. At times, by the cause and effect internally in my life, I've almost come to believe that alcoholism has a life of its own. Like it's almost as if it creates an uncanny resistance in me and in us to doing the things that will check it or curtail it or make it not dominant. I think it's the ego. But you see it when you're first new and they tell you you got to get a sponsor. The battle some of us go through asking somebody, oh my God, it's hard. I tell the guys I sponsor, I want you to go to these places where all the new people are, and you go up to them. Remember, Bill Wilson didn't wait for Dr. Bob to ask for help. Matter of fact, Dr. Bob didn't want help. You ask them because you need to find somebody to work with. And they'll say, what do I do? I said, well, you go up to them and you say, hi, my name's Bob. Here's my phone number. Do you have a sponsor? And if they say yes, say, well, here's a good backup number. You can call me anytime. If they say no, you say to them, you know, I really need to help people, and it would be an honor for me to help you. And if you want a sponsor, I would be delighted to do it. And the response that they get, sometimes people are like this, but often the guy's just, his whole demeanor shifts, and he goes, yes, because he'd been battling with himself and his own fear of rejection to ask someone for a couple weeks now, and he can't get through it. And you solved his problem for him. And you don't know that until you try. And there's an old spiritual principle. You throw enough shit up against the wall, some of it sticks. And if you keep throwing, you keep flinging, and within a couple years, the big promise comes true. That God will show you how to create the fellowship you crave. You get out in the trenches in Alcoholics Anonymous, and you start making yourself available. And you start trying to help people, no matter how lonely you feel, within no time at all, a fellowship will grow up around you. And I get guys I sponsor that they're mopes. And I push them into service right away. And within a year, 2 years, you see them at meetings and they got 5 or 6 guys. And now their problems aren't their own anymore. I sponsor a lot of guys, and I have to get them into sponsoring people quick, because if I don't, they are very tedious. Oh my God. Oh, I think if I had 15 guys that didn't help anybody at the same time, I would hang myself. I wouldn't want to answer the phone. It would be like, oh no, you know, just because we're so narcissistic. And once they start sponsoring people and helping, they don't know it, but there's a shift. All of a sudden, now they're calling you. They're calling you to tell you about the knucklehead thing the guy said. Right? And I said, you know, that's kind of like what you said, you know? Right? Well, that's the great, that's the universal sponsor's prayer to their, I hope you get a sponsee just like you. And we do. And we do. Over and over and over again. So it is the progressive nature of alcoholism that brings us into a state of reasonableness. And the book says we become as willing as only the dying can be. And two things have to occur for me to change my life. Is I have to get to a point of total collapse. In 1939, Bill said that we had but two alternatives: to go into the bitter end, blotting out our intolerable situation as best we could, or else to seek spiritual help. And that's what seems to be like, you know. It was that way when I got sober. I don't know that it's that way anymore. I think a lot of new people get sober now, and it's not two alternatives anymore. There's all kinds of promises out there of things for relief. And given the choice between relief and an awkward, difficult, inconvenient vehicle to change, alcoholics pick the relief every time, because the truth is we don't want to change. We want relief. We want gratification. We want to feel better. And most new people today, if I would get sober today, I would have a hard time, because I'm a depressive guy. I don't think I could have weathered my own emotional untreated alcoholism long enough to implement the program of recovery, which was going to change my life dramatically, because the minute you're in treatment, they're throwing things at you, alternatives, things for relief that'll make you feel better. But I don't need relief. I need change. I need to get free. I need to get free from the bondage of self. I don't need something that's going to make it okay for me to be self-centered. I need something that will free me from the bondage of self. Because if I don't, nothing will change. And then what happens is it's temporary relief. I have at least a half dozen friends that have sought other methods for relief rather than work the steps and do everything we do here. And it helped them for a number of years. And then 10 years later, they blow their brains out because what they were taking no longer works and the doctors don't know what else to give them. And they're trying to add supplements and more stuff. And you get into that terminal condition where the receptors in the brain, where the instrument in the brain that produces the serotonin now is atrophied like an unused muscle. And they're in trouble. I've had some really, really dear friends commit suicide as a result of that. And the doctors just continue to drive around in their Mercedes and play golf. They don't care. You know, they don't care. And it's a sad deal. My one friend, he was 23 years sober. His sponsor died. He started gambling. And he would gamble away almost his whole paycheck, and he would sink into a deep depression. And he never told the doctor about the gambling, he only told him about the depression. And he was given medication that he got enough relief he could continue to gamble. And at 32 and a half years sober, he blew his brains out, almost 10 years later. My friend Rob, who had been a sexually abused child, And as a result, he had incidences of where he, of pedophilia, where he'd become a pedophile. And he was 14 years in abstinence from that in Alcoholics Anonymous. And then he found a website that catered to people like that. And he started meeting these kids. And every time he'd have an episode, he'd sink into like a hangover, like a, an emotional depression afterwards. And a doctor gave him medication that so he could continue the behavior and not pay the price. See, the thing that I want relief from is often God's instrument to kick me in the butt and push me into action. There, I heard Sandy Beach tell this story 30 years ago. Sandy was a pilot, and he said, it was very interesting the way he put it. He said that in the old days, when you were, if you were trying to land a plane in bad weather, you had these headphones on. And if you got on what was called the beam, and if you got off the beam too much to the left, you got this Morse code that was irritating. The further you got off the beam, the more irritating it would become until it was eventually wow, 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 and your headphones, it would drive you crazy. So you'd have to bring it back until it was You got up to the other side to be wow, wow, it would be a different sound. Irritating. And he said, but you kept on the beam and you could land in fog and rain and storm, and you could land right on that runway smooth. The problem is that it's irritating. So when you take something to numb that, it's like taking the headphones off. You get temporary relief from the irritant, but you're going to land your plane in, on the side of a mountain. I mean, that's the problem. And and that's God's beam. My emotions are, I was given an internal compass. I am not a psychopath. I have this thing. If there's something I'm not letting go of, or some judgment I'm hanging on to because I want to be right about that jerk, or something I'm squirming around and doing I ain't supposed to be doing, I got some little secret in my life that I shouldn't have, I got this compass that starts being like you're off the beam. And I start feeling uncomfortable. And the alcoholic mind, I'm used to medicating the discomfort to continue the selfish behavior. Right? And it is God's compass to bring me on the beam. And that, a lot of what we do in Alcoholics Anonymous is trying to awaken to the God within us. See, the real problem with alcoholism is talked about in the beginning of the second page of We Agnostics. It says lack of power. That was our dilemma. And it goes on to say we had to find the power by which we could live. See, that's my big secret, is that I can't live in this world with me. I ain't no good. I ain't right. And I can't, and all the therapists and all the things I tried, nothing could make me all right enough where I felt free in this world. The freedom I had in the early days of drinking, when I could come out and play and I felt like I have to find a way to duplicate that. And I must find a power by which I could live. I have to. And the thing about Alcoholics Anonymous, we don't really take a position against any other treatment for this disease. If some of this other stuff will work for you, our hats are off to you. We just know it hasn't worked for us. No human power. So we have to find a power. Because I love drunks. And if I have a guy I sponsor and he finds something that will work for him other than AA, and it changes his life and he's good, I'm cheering for him. It's just I couldn't ever find anything. AA really and truly was the last house on the block for me. And that is just my experience. And it's the experience of a lot of people I work with. So we must find this power in which we can live. And Alcoholics Anonymous is about a quest for power. We're going to come back in about whatever time we're scheduled to come back at 11, and we'll come back at 11, and we'll start talking about how do you access this power. This is not metaphysical crap. This is pragmatic stuff. Alcoholics Anonymous is like spiritual physics. It's a game plan, and what implemented will guarantee you the power to change your life. Guarantee you. And if it didn't do that, how are we going to stay here? Let's take a break.
Okay, we'll come back at 11 o'clock.